This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, it's that time of the year when we welcome back good friend Kevin Frank. Kevin is an associate professor in the Department of Plant, Soil, and Microbial Sciences at Michigan State University. He's also an MSU Ag Bioresearch Scientist. And more importantly for this interview, he's here to give us some spring lawn care tips. Kevin, good to see you again.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Well, Kevin, last spring we had March that was pretty warm, and then we had a brutal April. This year, a little bit more normal. What does it mean for folks that are wanting that green lawn this spring and summer?
I think probably the first thing it means for most people is be patient. You know, last year we got this crazy weather in March and everything was going by now and people were outside doing lawn care and playing golf and all that sort of stuff. And this year, you know, you really, there's nothing to do. I mean, you're kind of waiting for the grass to grow at this point, and we're slowly warming up. I think we're going to start to see it here pretty quick, but I think that's the biggest thing for a lot of people is just be patient. Don't necessarily rush out there and think you have to do something until we actually get some growth and warmth.
You know, when we talk about weather these days, it's sort of like the new normal is abnormal, but this seems to be more of a normal warming pattern this year as opposed to the anomaly we saw last year.
Yeah, it's probably, you know, from a lot of the plant industries especially, this is probably a better start to the year than what we had last year. You know, for turf grass, I think the biggest thing is, you know, a lot of people get eager to get out there and maybe apply fertilizer and get things going. But in most cases, I try to tell people, you know, just like I said earlier, try to wait till you actually see some growth till the plant is actually going. If you push it too much with fertilizer at this time of the year, you'll really, you know, enjoy mowing even more, which most people don't.
Right.
And in some respects, you might end up reducing some root growth because you're just forcing more and more top growth, which as soon as we really get the warmth, you're going to see that growth anyway. So try to be a little patient just with the fertilizer apps right now.
You know, Kevin, there's been a lot in the news about runoff into our Great Lakes, et cetera, and a lot of homeowners really want to do the right thing environmentally. Yeah. What are some things, what are some tips that you might give them to make sure that what they're doing is sustainable and environmentally friendly?
Yeah, probably a couple things to realize. First, we do have a phosphorus restriction in place in the state for applications to turf grass. So most of the homeowners are probably, they may not be aware of it, but when they go into the store to buy a fertilizer, it probably doesn't have phosphorus in it. There's zero for that analysis. So that's one of the first things. Unless you have a soil test that indicates need, you don't need to apply phosphorus to your lawn. Other simple things are, you know, where you apply the fertilizer. Keep it on the turf. Don't have it going into the street or onto the sidewalk or on your driveway. If it does, you need to try to sweep that back or blow it with a leaf blower or something back into the turf. Simply because, obviously, if you get a rainfall event, just washes it right down the drain. And all the pipes are connected, so to speak. It goes to water eventually.
Do you have any recommendations? I know you have to be careful about being specific to a brand, but for fertilizer spreaders, a certain type that's better than other types?
You know, what I would generally say to a lot of folks is, how long ago did you get your fertilizer spreader? A lot of people hang on to them for a long time. They're not that expensive relatively. You know, you can probably get a decent one for $30. Maybe that's an expensive one even. And now they have simple things like deflector shields on them. So when you're going next to the curb, you can put that deflector shield in place, and it actually adjusts how much fertilizer is delivered in the pattern of where it goes. So in some cases, I say, you know, maybe just take a look at your spreader and see if it's time for a little upgrade this spring.
You mentioned soil testing, and that's something in agriculture that's fairly common. And on golf courses, I assume it is common as well.
Yes.
But a lot of homeowners may not do soil testing. How often should that be done?
You know, generally the recs on soil testing are probably like once every 3 years. You know, if you don't have any problems with your lawn and everything's going well, and don't know that you necessarily need to go out and get a soil test, but you know, for those that like to garden a little more and like to learn a little bit about what's going on in the soil that's supporting these plants, soil tests will certainly give you some information. As I mentioned with the phosphorus restriction, could let you know if you do need phosphorus, because most of the fertilizers you buy now aren't going to have it in. And there are some soils in the state, especially if you're on a home site where the soil is really disturbed and maybe you don't have the greatest topsoil, where you might actually require some phosphorus. So that's where a soil test would come in handy.
Sometimes you hear or we get flyers from lawn care services. Most of us probably do. Any general comments on lawn care services, what to look for, things to beware of?
I think the biggest thing for lawn care services is don't be afraid to ask questions. Don't be afraid to, if you want to have a lawn care service company service your property, to ask them, well, what about weed control or how many fertilizer apps? Or maybe you want them to use more natural organic fertilizers, for example, which that can be a possibility. It can also be a challenge these days because of the phosphorus restriction. But that's the biggest thing. I think a lot of people, you know, they'll call me up every now and then this time of year and say, hey, do you got a lawn care company you can recommend? And I'll say, well, go to the Yellow Pages. You know, I mean, look, just like shopping for a car, don't be afraid to ask questions. They do have different programs. It's not always a one-size-fits-all for the consumer.
Yeah, that's because most of us would have no way of distinguishing the claims of one from the claims of another. So be prepared, do your research, and then do an interview, essentially.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of the companies now are going to come out and do an initial site assessment, and as part of that, they will probably take a soil test. So, you know, they're experts. These people are well trained. They know their business. But don't be afraid to engage them and not just say, hey, I want program number one, for example.
My guest is Kevin Frank. He's a lawn care turf grass expert at Michigan State University in the Department of Plant, Soil, and Microbial Sciences. He's also funded in part by MSU Ag Bio Research. We've talked a lot about fertilizer here. Kevin, what about aeration and things of that nature and rolling lawns and other things that people think about?
Yeah, spring is often a time when you see the rollers come out and in many cases, I think it's almost recreational for them. You might smooth some lumps and bumps, especially as you come out of this time. But it's kind of like, you know, when you're driving down the road these days and you're trying to dodge potholes. You know, soil's moving around a little bit. It's still, you know, coming out of the freeze. It's melt. It's thaw. You know, it's a, I generally say wait till the grass really starts to grow, and it generally kind of smooths itself out, and especially once we get maybe some rain showers, that tends to do that also. So if you're going to roll, you know, maybe you're doing to flatten molehills a little bit that have popped up, but I wouldn't try to, like, steamroll your lawn flat.
Well,
if that makes
it's
sense.
Funny you mentioned it, but, you know, instead of going to the workout place and hitting the treadmill or something, maybe just push that roller around. Well,
yeah, if you're actually pushing the roller, yeah, that could be a good workout for you.
Again, you mentioned being patient and waiting for the grass to start growing. I mean, any particular height or do you look more at temperature when you actually start treating your lawn?
I always try to tell people, you know, what height do you normally mow at? If that's maybe 2.5 inches would be hopefully on the low side and hopefully a lot of around 3 inches. When you go out there and you have your mower set at 3 inches, are you cutting any grass yet, or are you, not to use the same line, but are you recreationally mowing?
Right.
You know, do you go out there and get lost because you can't tell what you mowed and what you did?
Right. Yeah. My producer, Russ White, does a lot of recreational mowing. I think he tells me. But speaking of mowing, is 3 inches about what you recommend?
I think 3 inches is a great height. You know, if you've been mowing lower, give it a try. It's going to take a little while. I mean, grass literally almost is trained to mowing heights. So if you try to jump around in mowing heights, I think you have some danger occasionally of either scalping the turf or if you're going up, give it a little time because it will take a little time to adjust to it, maybe get the density that you want. You certainly don't want it lodging over, you know, nobody likes that look. But 3 inches would be a great height for most lawns. It'll help you get better root growth than the short lawn.
Now, some people wonder, too, when they're mowing, is it good to mow the same way all the time, or is it good to change your directions, do diagonal, vertical, what have you? Does it matter?
You know, if you're talking about a push mower, it probably doesn't matter. I mean, there's not a lot of weight to that mower, and you're not going to really, I don't think, rut up the soil by always doing the same path. What you do see problems with is larger pieces of equipment. A lot of zero-turn mowers now that are being used in landscapes, both by homeowners and obviously the professionals. Sometimes varying the pattern on that type of riding mower can be important.
Is that because of soil compaction?
A lot of it is just soil compaction. I've seen some sites where, you know, around like condominiums where it's very difficult for those mowers to go different directions, and you see some, over years, literally tracks because they've always mowed the exact same path.
Yeah, right. Like ruts. You get
literally. You can see it visually.
Well, Kevin, as I always ask at the close of our interviews, so where can folks go to get more information on lawn care, turf management, et cetera? I know MSU has got a wonderful site.
Yeah, you can just go to our main webpage for the Turfgrass Group, and that's turf.msu.edu. And there's links to a weed site there for identifying weeds, which is important. We now have a disease site, so you can identify your own diseases if you're unfortunate enough to have any. So really, that's kind of the clearinghouse to start with, is turf.msu.edu.
A wonderful site. Well, I've been talking with good friend Kevin Frank, Associate Professor at Michigan State University in the Department of Plant, Soil, and Microbial Sciences. And Kevin, it's kind of nice to have some normalcy in the weather patterns this year compared to last.
It is good, but I'm like a lot of people, I'm itching to go. I'm ready to get outside.
For some recreational mowing.
Yep.
Thanks so much, Kevin.
Thank you.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com. You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. We've all heard the expression, it's all about who you know. And wherever you are on your career ladder, having a friend on the inside can make all the difference. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, you're instantly connected to a half a million Spartans around the world, many of whom are key decision makers in just about every major enterprise. Whether you're looking for a way in or a way up, your MSU Alumni Association affiliation can help you link up with that MSU alum who'll always take your call just because you're a Spartan. Building your network right now before you need it is the best possible career insurance, and joining the MSU Alumni Association is the best possible way to get the most out of your Spartan life. Learn more online at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Russ White.
MSU J School alumnus Bill Emko is Director of State News for MLive.com. Welcome, Bill. What exactly do you do in your role at MLive.com?
Well, I'm the Director of State News. I oversee the reporters that cover the state capitol, business on a statewide level, entertainment on a statewide level, as well as the pro and college sports reporters for MLive.com. That's what I do. I work with reporters on their techniques, online techniques, web techniques, what works, how to engage with the audience. That's what I do.
Because what are the challenges in trying to engage now, right? We're just bombarded with information. What are those challenges in this new world?
It's been part of my philosophy for a long time, as you guys know, that the audience is what is the most important thing. This can be misconstrued in journalism circles. I think it can be misconstrued as saying, "Oh, you're chasing hits." It's actually page views. It's not hits. But there's nothing wrong with going out and finding something that's popular. But I'm not interested in just finding what's popular. I want to find something that is meaningful, and I believe that journalism. In-depth journalism can operate online in a 24-hour environment beyond just breaking news. I think enterprise journalism can exist. I think it can be told in a certain way. It's how you package it. It's how you work with it. And it's my belief that journalism has a very bright future. But I think when you say, "Oh, you're just chasing hits," it's offensive to me, and it's irritating, because if the audience wants it, you give it to the audience. And you always be, if the customer's always right, if they want it, they want it. And I think there's ways to do enterprise in that environment. And I just don't think a lot of people know how.
Bill, you mentioned enterprise journalism. We talked to Tom Friedman a couple of years ago, and one of his biggest concerns with this proliferation is, you know, who are the gatekeepers anymore? Who are the editors? Who makes sure that the information that we're accessing on MLive.com, whether it's sports or politics or what have you, is good, solid, vetted information?
I think there's different ways to look at it. First of all, in sports, with the reporters that I have, I hire, the way I operate is I look for the highest level reporters that I could possibly find, the most trustworthy, the cleanest writers, the people that know how to communicate, and that I say the number one criteria is that you have an open mind. So for that information, I trust that the beat reporters are gathering their information. They cross-check each other, like James and Chris, on how they get their stuff done. You know, they cross-check each other, they fact-check each other. But and so there's not an editor in that situation. But sports is different than news. We just came off of a major enterprise series that we worked on for a week on school safety called Code Red. And it talked about whether schools are prepared with their tornado drills and their lockdown drills and fire drills and whether they're actually executing them. Well, that's all vetted by John Barnes, who works on my statewide team. He used to be the former managing editor at the Grand Rapids Press, but now he's a statewide projects coordinator. He works with the reporters, some of them are very young, on vetting, on cross-checking, on data gather, data analysis. He works with them. You know, it's almost like it's become a university itself because not a lot of the schools are teaching the stuff that we need. So John Barnes works like a professor on that stuff. Now, on day-to-day things like breaking news, there are what we call managing producers in each of our local hubs. And the managing producers act kind of like managing editors, but they manage the staff, but they also work with the copy desk and work with our digital operations team for presentation for online. And you know, part of the way it works is whenever, you know, there's going to be some stories that are pretty straightforward, pretty much clean. You understand what you're doing. Then there's going to be some stories where you're just not sure. And that's when we rely on our reporters to raise their hand and say, this one, I'm not sure yet. And I would say that goes right to the managing producer, and then that's what they do. They clean it up and edit it, and it has not been a problem.
And, Bill, based on sort of where you say this is all going, what kind of, maybe it's obvious, but what is the MLive.com kind of strategy, particularly mm-hmm. like, say, when you're moving into Lansing like you are and into sports? Is there a strategy? Is
yeah,
it 24/7? I mean, in commentary and
there is the strategy that we have in our expansion hubs. We have expansion hubs in Detroit and Lansing. What I mean by expansion is in the old newspaper world, we had newspapers in 8 markets, and we didn't have a newspaper in Lansing or Detroit. But it just so happens that MLive.com has massive audience in Lansing, number one website in Lansing, and we were at the time we launched our Detroit edition, we were number 6 in Detroit in total local news source, and then we moved up to a couple months ago, we hit number 1 for the first time, and that's without a newspaper. Now, it was web audience, and we don't have the brand of the Detroit Free Press. We're not as recognized. I think we're far more recognized in Lansing because of our sports coverage, because of our politics coverage, and you know, and how we cover the Capitol and how we cover the Spartans, frankly. So I think the strategy is, for Lansing was different from Detroit. When we come into Lansing, I mean, we already were a major entity on the web for a local news source in Lansing before we ever set boots on the ground.
Yeah.
That's what's different. You know, we know, we can tell where the audience is coming from, and Ingham County was the 5th largest county for all of MLive's audience in the entire site, and we didn't have a newspaper here. And so why? I can't tell you the exact reasons why. I can give you educated guesses as to why, but all we know is we have audience. And so how do you make that audience understand what you are and what you're doing, and how do you feel local to them? You add some local reporting to it. And that's what we did. We added 2 local reporters. And I think in journalism circles, people roll their eyes and say, you just added 2 local reporters. How are you really going to compete? Well, we had no reporters and we were competing.
Your sports page views kind of swamp everything else. I mean, what percentage of people are going to, of your page views are sports compared to all the rest? And where is that headed?
You know, you'd be surprised. I mean, local reporting you can classify news versus sports, and sports could count as high school sports as well as professional sports. You could say local news, like your Jackson News and your Bay City News, are 2 of our smallest markets, and as well as our enterprise stuff all the way up to the Code Red series, is news versus sports. I think you would be shocked. It's not as much of a discrepancy as you'd say. I mean, I don't know the numbers off the top of my head. I'm going to guess and just throw a number on the table and say it's probably 60% sports, 40% news, but it might even be 50-50 at this point, because we are – you know, the fellow directors on our content side, they hear me say this a lot. We're number one in every market, and we're growing at a record pace. Number one in every market, and we're growing at a record pace. So for all the, you know, the issues that we face on a day-to-day basis, I remind everybody of that. It's become my mantra. You could put it on my headstone.
Bill, let me ask you, based on kind of what we've been talking about, we said you're a J-school grad from, I think you told me, 97.
Yep.
What did these kids here now need to know? And if, like, Bill was coming in 93 or whatever it was, based on how it's changed, you would say, you know what, 30% of what they taught then, you know, critical thinking, whatever. What do you think, how much of that is different now just because things have changed? I mean, how much of it, I guess, then is the delivery? How much is the content? But
it's
there's
radically
a lot
different.
There, but what are your thoughts?
Oh, it's radically different. I mean, when I got here, there was, you know, I got my first email address when I got here, and... You know, it just kind of went from there. I remember it was my sophomore year. We got server space. I taught myself HTML before I ever had server space. Matter of fact, I didn't even know how to put the HTML on the internet. I actually didn't know what to do. I actually wrote it on an actual piece of notepad. I was learning it, and I was handwriting it on a notepad. And then one day, I didn't know who to ask. So I emailed webmaster@msu.edu, and the guy responded and told me file transfer protocol and FTP. And it, I mean, that's
the
how it happened.
The rest is history.
And the rest is history. But, yeah, how much has changed? Yeah, it's completely changed. And I would even go as far to say as Michigan State's got to go a lot further in terms of getting up to speed. I do think they're in – and I'll be pretty critical of it. And the students coming out of the school just aren't quite ready for what we do. I'll tell you this. I was just down in Alabama about a month ago, meeting with our family site, our sister site, AlabamaAL.com, Alabama Media Group. And we are, there are where we are. You know, they do things differently. They have Alabama football. You know, obviously, they have a bunch of local market hubs like we do at Michigan. We went down there, and we were in Mobile. And there was a young reporter about, probably 23 years old, 24 years old, female. She came up to me after it was Kelly Frick is my community news director. She handles the local news. Kelly is my counterpart. We're really good friends, and we both went down to Alabama. And this young lady came up to us and said, I graduated from Michigan State, and I didn't want to be a part of MLive. I didn't think it was good journalism. I didn't think it was very good at all. And now Alabama Media Group is pulling us down there to talk about the successes we've had in Michigan. And she said, now you're bringing MLive to Alabama. And it's like, well, and you know what I said to her is if you felt that we weren't doing the right things, that means you don't know what we were doing. And now you're in the company. Now you're in a different state. You're not even in your home state anymore. I thought you were going to go work at a newspaper and revive your career. Whereas what we're doing is pretty groundbreaking in my estimation. And I can see this even in our company where we're seeing audience growth. What we do is pretty groundbreaking. And it's kind of a slap in the face to say, you know, that you don't know what you're doing. And yet, we're number one in every market.
And I guess you would argue you're probably the trend, too. And so they're not – what is it they need to learn that they aren't learning, do you think? I mean –
they're all – it's pretty basic. In, I guess it's my mind.
In the 2 minutes we have left.
Yeah.
You know?
Engagement. Don't ever be afraid of your audience. Don't ever be afraid of how your audience congregates. Don't be afraid of where your audience congregates. If the audience does not congregate on MLive.com on the subject that I want them to congregate on, you know, if I don't own the community, if the community doesn't reside on MLive.com, don't be afraid of sending your reporters to where the community exists. You know, I make this discussion all the time with my Spartans reporters as we build it up, and Mike Griffith and Diamond Leung are, you know, Diamond's been here for a year, and Mike's been here since October, brought him up after covering the SEC for 20 years to cover Michigan State. Local Mason boy, too, brought him back home. when I say to them, I said, look, you know, we're growing our Spartans coverage audience. You know, here's certain things you got to do. But ultimately, a big chunk of that audience is on SpartanTailgate.com. It's on Scout. It's on Rivals. Don't be afraid for the next frontier to engage on that universe.
Interesting.
You know, I'm not afraid. Don't be afraid of Twitter. Don't be afraid of Facebook. Don't be afraid of where that audience exists. Because it's about, we're not about chasing hits. We're about becoming relevant. Relevancy is the number one goal, more so than traffic. It's just the only way to really truly measure relevancy in my universe is by page views.
That's MLive.com's Director of State News, Bill Emko.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. We'll have more in a moment.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, We're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's more with Russ White.
I'm Russ White for MSU Today. Organizations are increasingly structuring themselves around teams, and this change in the nature of work presents many challenges and opportunities for future managers. Michigan State University's Broad College of Business and Department of Intercollegiate Athletics are joining forces to offer organizations the opportunity to participate in a new executive development initiative designed to meet this challenge.
Yes, we've been thinking for several years of trying to put a joint program together with the coaches and the management department. The management department is year in, year out, rated number one in research productivity in our area. The Broad School has a very heavy emphasis on teams, and obviously we've got great coaching staff over here that also has a lot of experience kind of managing teams. And so we always kind of played around with the idea it would be great to get the academic side of the team building together with the sports side of the team building and do something that's really creative and really different that would respond to the needs of the business market.
That's MSU Broad College of Business Management Professor John Hollenbeck, who helped develop the program. Building Winning Teams, A Quest for Excellence is an executive leadership program targeted for high-potential business professionals who lead a team or contribute to their team's success.
Yeah, basically this is anybody who wants to develop skills in both building new teams or sustaining teams that are already effective or managing change in teams that need to be turned around. All these are topics that are going to be covered. All of these coaches have experience doing all those things. And there's a large scientific literature dealing with these things as well. The faculty over the management department, we have five professors involved in this. They have over 100 years experience doing research and teaching in this area, publishing in this area, writing textbooks. And the amazing thing for me, I've written textbooks in this area, is the coaches have so much experience, how often they give the absolute perfect textbook answer to a lot of these questions, even though you think maybe they didn't read the textbook. I really think they've kind of developed this experience on their own. They have a good intuitive feel for it. They've learned from their own experiences, and that's why they're coaching at this level, because they get it. And we've been doing a lot of interviews and a lot of taping, and we've got just great anecdotes from the coaches that depict in very vivid ways, very memorable ways, perfect examples of kind of textbook team building and team change.
The program features many MSU coaches, including Tom Izzo, Mark D'Antonio, Susie Merchant, Tom Anastas, Stacy Slobodnik-Stoll, and volleyball coach Kathy George.
Well, it's so funny what John was talking about is how we're so similar to organizations and businesses that are trying to run efficiently. And it is. We look at every little part of our team to try to make sure we're operating in the most healthy, effective way. And when you're talking about teams, you're talking about people with different needs, different wants, different desires, and you need to pull it all together to get a culture that can work for the mission and not for themselves. And when you can have organizational health, when you can have people pulling in the same direction, you're going to go places. When things break down on a team or the leadership isn't effective, you'll find that we're spinning wheels. And as John pointed out, we have to be judged on that every week and every season. And so we need to make sure that we're working, we're studying our teams, we're learning about that. I'm very excited to be a part of this because I'll learn more. And I read so many different books and I try to put them into motion, things that I can get behind. And I watch my teams grow. And I love watching teams grow because when they're on the right page, they're really something.
The ability to create and sustain excellence through teams is vital to organizational success. This unique MSU collaboration will provide participants of this executive leadership program the opportunity to enhance their skills to build a strong team structure and culture, select and recruit top talent, build team performance through accountability, make effective strategic and tactical decisions, manage conflict and promote perception of fairness,
and bring about change and team development.
I'm going to be covering the topic of conflict and negotiation.
That's Broad Management Professor Don Conlon.
In particular, with our focus on teams here, I'll be talking about multi-party negotiations. Many times you're involved in a negotiation with more than just two parties. There could be three, four, even six different individuals who have a different perspective that they're trying to lobby for in a group discussion. The irony is many times you may think everybody wants the same outcome in a team, but sometimes people have personal preferences or goals that can be very much opposed to what other people want. And so you need to really listen carefully and communicate, keep a focus on what the superordinate goal is that people are trying to achieve, and see if you can make sure that you can build that coalition where everybody feels like this is a good idea for them.
David Frayer leads the MSU Broad College Executive Education Program and says the program reflects MSU's orientation to leadership through teams.
So, you know, I think one of the things that's truly unique about this program is that it absolutely reflects Michigan State University's overall orientation toward leadership and the fact that leadership is really achieved through teams. And through the performance of people working together. A lot of organizations, a lot of schools, a lot of people really put a focus on individual leadership, you know, charisma and all of the important attributes of the individual. But I think what makes this program unique, I think what makes our university unique, I think what makes our sports programs, our athletic program unique, is the fact that the orientation is very much on team, leading through teams, leading through others, finding roles for everyone, and finding ways to really raise the bar for the entire organization.
Hollenbeck says there's a particular synergy created when business and athletics come together.
Well, certainly kind of any building teams deals with interpersonal issues and skill building issues and kind of managing conflict and making sure you get the right people on the team and keep the right people off the team. This is true in business as well. In sports. Now, the other thing, I think the coaches are highly visible kind of actors in their environment, which puts added pressure on there. So I think that they're ready to think about their decisions and defend their decisions and think about how to put teams together in a way that every manager would be better off. I think if every manager had to face ESPN at the end of a week or the end of the season, they'd be better managers. And so I really think that this kind of feedback and the experience that the coaches bring in terms of being highly visible actors in this environment is something that a business manager may not see anybody other than his or her own supervisor, let alone a national audience. But these coaches deal with national audiences, and there's definitely lessons our leaders can learn from what they've done over the years.
I do believe that we've been through. I've been coaching for 27 years, and I've seen teams that are operating very well and some that are falling apart. I've had to turn around. Oh, boy, I can't even count how many different programs, eight different times, three here where I've taken and had to turn a program around. And so one of the things John talked about was when you come in, you obviously have to change a culture. But sometimes cultures can slip on you even when you're going in the right direction through graduation or turnover or what have you. The culture can change. And how do you recognize those points when it is changing? You think you have it, everybody's on board, everything's going in the right direction, and now we're starting the next season and people assume they have the culture, they're not working towards the culture, or they're not working towards the mission. And you forget. So we have to kind of always keep our thumb on it. We always have to be working with our leadership to make sure that everybody is on the same page and that we're not becoming selfish.
Hollenbeck says the program will be thorough and the coaches involved will add their unique perspectives.
Well, basically, we really want to start kind of cradle to grave in terms of building a team. For example, how do you structure roles? How do you build the team's culture? That is, what values are we all going to share that kind of keep us the same? How do you go on and recruit and decide who's going to be on the team and who's not? In many cases, the most talented individuals are recruited by more than one school, or in this case, by more than one organization. And so what can we learn to help get the best talent to our company as opposed to some other company? We're going to be looking at decision-making. How do you make good individual decisions, group decisions at both the tactical and strategic level? And again, that's something that happens in both business and in sports. We'll look at conflict management in terms of how do you manage the different personalities or the different interests on a team. Again, that happens in sports as well as business. And in many cases, the feedback you get sometimes in a sports context is a little bit faster. Businesses tend to get feedback on a slower quarterly basis or annual basis. In coaching, you pretty much get feedback after every single performance event, and so people can learn. And then we talk about change management. So, for example, Coach D'Antonio comes in and he has to basically change the culture from what he learned. I know other coaches have had to change the culture of the programs that they've gone into. Often you get a new job as a coach because the program isn't where it needs to be. So you come in as a brand new coach, you have to turn that culture around. And it's one thing to build a culture from scratch, quite another to come in and change your culture from one thing to another. So we'll have a section on changing the culture, changing the strategies, changing the mission of teams as well. And I think both the coaches and business managers have to deal with it, but I just think the nature of coaching, the feedback cycles you get, the visibility of it, perhaps makes you a little bit more sensitive and attuned, and you either learn fast or you get into another line of work. Again, I think there's a lot of kind of textbook material that really kind of takes on a life when a coach gives kind of a vivid description of what happens. For example, one of the interviews we had with Coach Izzo, we asked him, you know, many times you have to make an adjustment to your strategy. Tell us the best halftime adjustment that you ever made. And again, there's textbooks written about how to make kind of halfway point adjustments in teams. And he tells a great story about the best halftime adjustment he ever made was one that he actually wound up doing nothing. He was trying to figure out if he should yell at this team because they weren't doing well at halftime, but their confidence was already low. He didn't know if he should try to build them up. And on the way to the locker room, he was trying to figure out what he was going to do. And when he got there, Mateen Cleaves already had one of his best friends pinned up against the wall screaming at him. And basically, he said, the best halftime adjustment I ever made was made by Mateen Cleaves. And Mateen Cleaves gave it to these people. And when he was done talking, I got up. I made a few things with X's and O's. And we went out and we overcame a 17-point deficit and went on to win the national championship. Now, there's a lesson there about – he'll talk about how, why player-led teams are always better than coach-led teams. And so the question in the business organization, definitely employee-led organizations are better than CEO-led organizations because you can't be there. You need leadership out of everybody in the organization and common values. And so you can talk about how the 2000 team and how Mateen Cleaves and how the other players kind of bought into the system and that became a player-led team. I just think that's a really super vivid example. And, of course, when we do that in class, we'll have a clip of the Syracuse versus Michigan State game and what the second half looked like. But, again, I think it's a very vivid example of the kind of things that sometimes in the textbook treatment of it isn't that memorable. But we are wrapping really great stories and narratives around really good textbook material in a way that I don't think a lot of other programs can manage.
Professor Hollenbeck adds that managers and members of teams who go through the program will learn to manage and build teams.
Well, I think everybody who attends this session is going to learn a lot about how to manage and build their own teams. And so if you're managing any kind of team or leading a team, that's going to be a very important element. But moreover, even if you're not leading the team or managing the team, if you're part of a team, a lot of this is influencing without authority. You may not be the formal manager of the team, and yet you might have the important critical answer. How do you get the team to recognize this, maybe even if you're not a formal leader of a team? So it's not just for people that are leading teams, but it's for people who want to lead teams, people who want to be influential, even though they're maybe not a formal leader of a team, how to get people to be more influential and having a better impact on their group and their organization.
The program is limited to 50 participants and is an opportunity to learn from the world-renowned management faculty and the outstanding coaching staff at Michigan State University.
The first time, I think, is really kind of critical. I think you learn, like in coaching, I think you learn your most from your first to your second game. I think in many cases in executive development, you learn the most from the first to the second time you do something. And so we'll kind of get a feel for this audience. We do a lot of executive development work right now. I mean, we do 5 or 6 sessions a year with executives, and we'll see how this audience, because of the sports angle, compares with the normal executive development audience that we have. And so it's going to be a learning experience. I've already learned some great things just from interviewing the coaches. We even instilled a change in the management department based upon something that we got out of an interview with Coach Izzo that was a wonderful idea. Even though, like, we have 100 years of experience, we don't leverage that in our own department. And now we do. And we could talk about what that is, but to actually get it, you're going to have to come to the session to learn it. But even after 100 years of experience, Coach Izzo said something that Don and I walked out of the room and said, wow, we need to be doing that in the management department right away.
To register or learn more about Building Winning Teams, A Quest for Excellence, please visit edp.com. broad.msu.edu or contact Kristen St. Marie at 517-353-8711, extension 71005. Kristen's email is St. Marie, that's St. Marie without the period, STMARIE, St. Marie, at bus.msu.edu. And I'm Russ White for MSU Today.
More MSU Today in a moment on AM 870 WKAR.
I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Whether you're moving across town or across the country, relocating to a new job or a new city is always a challenge. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, wherever you go, you'll have an instant circle of friends on hand to help you get settled and get connected. With more than 100 clubs and affiliates around the world, there's a Spartan in just about every city. And as an MSU Alumni Association member, you'll quickly feel right at home. Wherever you go, community, connections, careers, and class, four great reasons to visit alumni.msu.edu today to activate your membership in the largest Spartan organization in the world. That's alumni.msu.edu, the Michigan State University Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
The University Research Corridor, empowering Michigan.
This is an association of the three research universities in Michigan to really collaborate on a deeper level than we have in the past and highlight for ourselves and for the region and for the nation the strength in technology, innovation, new research, investment that we think is going to help change the Michigan economy.
That's University of Michigan President Mary Sue Coleman.
The mission of the URC is no less than to help transform the Michigan economy and to make this a vibrant place that young people will want to come and stay, that businesses will want to be in, because we are a place where a lot is happening and we have the brain power for the new economy. It's here. It's in Michigan. We just need to tap it.
Visit us online at urcmich.org.
So Michigan is vibrant. Michigan has all these things, and we want to signal that to the entire world.
Visit the University Research Corridor online at urcmich.org.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Russ White.
I'm Russ White for Greening of the Great Lakes. The Lansing-based civil engineering firm Fitzgerald Henny & Associates is changing its name to ENG, but only the name is changing.
There are no differences. Okay. We are the same people, the same company. ENG is short. It's short for engineering. It says what we do, but it's not difficult to spell. We didn't want to go with Minshall and Dyer because eventually we're not going to be there, and we want the name to outlive, actually, the people. We are civil engineers, and we also have surveying services. But primarily, we do design work for municipalities. We do sewers, water mains, storm sewers, streets. We do a lot of drain work for county drains. We do some private development also. We do site plans. We sub out to architects that need the site planning. We do site development, subdivisions. We've done multi-use developments.
That's ENG President Greg Minshall, who adds that ENG is known in particular for a couple specialties.
Probably our two niches are one of the partners, Mike Dyer, is a very, very good road designer. One of the City of Lansing engineers has said that he's the best road designer in the area, which is quite a compliment. We also do a significant amount of county drain work. Michigan's unique in that it has actually county drain commissioners, which are an office, and we do a lot of that work. That's kind of specific because that's under the Michigan Drain Code, and the Michigan Drain Code, you have to know the processes, and not everybody knows that. We are probably one of the top five firms in the state doing that, which for our size is very good.
ENG does a lot of work for municipalities which are experiencing funding shortages.
Every community is down on money from the state on down to local villages. There just isn't enough money to do what they need to do. Roads, bridges, sewers. There's no compelling need to expand systems because the development pressure is not there. So the business is hurting. One of our largest firms in the state one of the larger firms in the state just a month ago closed their doors, just literally put, I don't know how many people they had, a couple of hundred, several offices just closed their doors. So, yeah, it's still a struggle.
LEED, or Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, provides a third-party verification of green buildings. But ENG's Minchell isn't necessarily a big fan of the program.
I'm not a big proponent of LEED. LEED is good if it's applied properly. There's been a lot of follow-up work with LEED that shows that the money they're spending and the return they're getting is not necessarily there. On the other hand, a lot of what we do in the design work for site plans, there is a more environmental approach to that, where 50 years ago the approach in Michigan was to drain all the swamps. Well, now we don't drain swamps, we protect wetlands and sometimes create wetlands. So stormwater drainage used to be you get the water away as fast as you can and down to the river and let the river handle it and the downstream people handle it. Now you retain it, you create habitat. Road design needs to be a little more environmentally sensitive. You don't necessarily have to design the road for as wide and as full of capacity. Now they want to slow things down a little bit, be more pedestrian friendly. Those are more the environmental issues than LEED.
Going through the LEED process isn't cheap either, says Minchell.
And the return isn't necessarily there. If you USA Today had a huge series of articles about it less than 2 months ago. And they're following up and saying that people who are just looking at it for the LEED certification are kind of missing the boat. They aren't necessarily, they're getting the certification, but they aren't doing what they necessarily need to do. So
interesting.
I take a little more practical approach. I think we do that we're going to do the best we can, but there's financial constraints, too.
In these tight economic times, Minchell says his goal is simply to stay in business.
Almost exactly 5 years ago, we had a strategic planning session, and we set about to set our goals, and we did a big sheet, and our goal was survive. Simply survive. I don't see a change to infrastructure funding in the near future. Well, it comes from taxes or user fees. Taxes are unpopular. People don't have enough money. And user fees are unpopular. I mean, you could take a look at the whole issue that they got into, whether we should raise registration fees for road funding. Well, nobody wants to send that out under their name, so who wants to send that out and have people pay more money? It's a very unpopular issue. User fees tend to oftentimes hurt people who can least afford it. I mean, if you take a person who is relatively wealthy or middle class versus a person who is not as wealthy, they still use the same amount of water, have the same amount of wastewater fees. So the thought is utility fees tend to favor the people who can more afford it and hurt more the people who can less afford it. So raising utility fees is not good. We're working with one community who has a 7% vacancy rate in their town. Well, if you can take a look at collecting sewer and water fees and your base rate stays, it costs you just as much to operate the system, so your fixed costs are the same, and you have 7% fewer people paying the fees, their discretionary part of their budget just went away. And that's true of every size city around here. I don't know of any that are actually growing.
Greg Minchell says there's more competition from big firms for jobs than ever before.
A lot of our work is still not changing. It's more competitive. There's been a lot of consolidation in our business. A lot of firms have sold out, couldn't make it, consolidated into larger firms. But because of the reduced amount of work, we're seeing a lot more pressure and competition from bigger firms. I mean, we've had some large national firms competing for relatively small parking lot projects, and that has hurt. That it used to be, if you had a client, you could be their engineer, and they would hire you, and you charged them a fair price, they paid you a fair wage, and you would give them good service, and that relationship went on. now that relationship might get you on the list to be able to submit a competitive proposal. So fair pricing is difficult right now. That was part of the big problem with the stimulus package, where they talked about shovel-ready projects. In our industry, I saw where they did a lot of what we used to call painting the driveway black. Literally, to save money, they'll do what's called a mill and resurface. Well, they'll just take off the top and put down a new road surface, but they aren't taking it down to the roots and fixing it, which is much more expensive, but may have a 20 to 30 year life versus the mill and resurface, which has maybe a 5 year life at best. They spent a lot of money and got a lot of Band-Aids, in my opinion.
Greg Minchell and his ENG civil engineering colleagues still love what they do.
If you can solve somebody's problem and get it done, and some of our best solutions you'll never see. In fact, we hope you don't see them, because if we solve the problem, you're going to drive to work, your road isn't going to flood, and you won't know that we've been there. And that's the best.
I'm Russ White for Greening of the Great Lakes.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
MSU, we love thy shadows.
Our mission is to be your personal network for life.
Scott Westerman leads the Michigan State University Alumni Association.
Sing our love for alma mater.
So what that means is, when you graduate from college, we'll help you find your first career. When you move to any city, anywhere, we'll help you connect and settle. If you're mid-career and want to reinvent yourself, we'll help you find a new passion. And if you need advice or a friend anywhere in the world, the MSU Alumni Association will connect you with the 500,000 Spartans out there that are always ready to take your call.
Join the Michigan State University Alumni Association online at alumni.msu.edu.
And thy praises, MSU.
alumni.msu.edu.
MSU AgBio Research is changing the face of science.
People should know that AgBio Research is really the first front at MSU dealing with environmental issues and natural resources issues.
Dr. Steve Pepke leads MSU AgBio Research. More than 300 scientists from 6 MSU colleges are leading innovation in food, natural resources, and energy.
MSU AgBio Research really is changing the face of science. If we can do that right, we create economic opportunities here in Michigan and opportunities for our researchers to make some really interesting discoveries.
Our goal is to generate economic prosperity, sustain natural resources, and enhance the quality of life for all.
We're MSU AgBio Research.
Visit agbioresearch.msu.edu. MSU AgBio Research is changing the face of science.
Turn it up, a little bit higher. Radio, turn it up, so you know. Radio.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.